Do we have a quorum and we have our staff present, so we'll go ahead and call this meeting to order of the Post Council for our first meeting for 2015. I want to welcome the staff members and the members of the council and all those present. A couple of things for housekeeping. We've asked been asked to excuse Commissioner Kerry Gibson, so we'll do so now. We also have two new members on the council. Sheriff Robert Decker from Miller County, welcome you here today. Also, Sheriff Cameron Noel from Beaver County, who will not be in attendance here today. With that, we'll go ahead and move into the agenda. First up on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for the December 8th, 2014 meeting. Hopefully you've had an opportunity to read those. I'll entertain any motions.
That's all.
Motion to approve and a second?
Second.
Any discussion or change? All those in favor to approve, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The minutes stand approved. We'll go ahead and turn the time over to Deputy Director Kelly Sparks.
Thank you, Chairman Tracy and council members. I have the annual report for the calendar year of 2014 for the post activity. First of all, in investigations, in our investigation section, which is headed by Lieutenant Al Acosta, Bureau Chief, we've received 157 complaints of peace officer misconduct in 2014. From those 157 complaints, 94 investigations were opened. The investigations section presented 54 cases to the Post Council for possible sanction in 2014. Those 54 cases resulted in the Council issuing 5 revocations and 35 suspensions, ranging from 3 months to 4 years, and 1 indefinite suspension. Council also issued 11 letters of caution and took no action on 2 of the cases that were presented. Some of the most frequent causes for peace officer discipline in 2014 were driving under the influence with 7 cases, domestic violence assault with 7 cases, sexual conduct on duty with 6 cases, and BCI usegis violations with 5 cases, and providing false information to obtain certification with 5 cases. The investigation section also conducted 22 investigations, which resulted in the allegation being unsustained, and 16 peace officers voluntarily relinquished their certification during the post-investigation process. The investigation section also conducted 938 background investigations on applicants for certification. From the training section, which is headed by Lieutenant Ray Brewer, the Bureau Chief, in 2014, the training section conducted 78 in-service training programs on 15 different topics, and these were attended by a total of 1,801 officers. 6 basic training sessions were held here at Post, and 166 individuals were certified as law enforcement officers. The total number of new peace officer certifications earned during 2014 for all training programs, including satellite academies, is 1,444. The media and technology section, managed by John Jacobs, major accomplishments for this division in 2014 were provided audiovisual equipment and support to the Public Safety Summit, to the Utah Prosecution Council's spring and fall conferences, and to various DPS videography and photography projects. Also created a public service announcement for the Don't Text and Drive campaign. Completed server migration project updating security standards on all of our systems. They conducted 5 live webinar training sessions and recorded and produced 2 DVD, the entire 40-hour basic public safety dispatcher training program. They also provided a number of live audio broadcasts and provided live audio broadcasts of all post-council meetings during 2014. Also complete an agreement with Salt Lake City Police Department, implementing that department as an ACADIS partner. Post online data systems, our ACADIS system, had the following usage activity. We had a monthly average of 1,552 unique portal users, conducted 9,291 online exams. That includes both basic and in-service examinations. And a recorded 8,398 observed tests, which includes defensive tactics and physical fitness. 526 training sessions were completed across all training. 12,726 training events were submitted by agencies in our annual in-service training report. And we had 963 online training events completed. And our system currently houses 26,475 individual person records. And that completes the report for 2014, unless the council has any questions.
Thank you, Deputy Director Sparks. Thank you. Any questions, any comments from the council? All right, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll move to the quarterly report. Lieutenant Al Acosta, Lieutenant Wade Brewer.
Good morning, council. What we received is a total of, since December 8th, last council meeting, we've received 41 complaints in the Investigations Bureau. We've opened up 21 investigations. We have conducted zero administrative hearings this quarter. We have 9 cases that we closed with no action, and we had 6 cases that we had voluntary relinquishments on. Allegations are unlawful sexual activity with a minor, stalking, unlawful detention, criminal trespass, falsifying government documents, lying on the post application, and illegal use of illicit drugs, to include marijuana. We've done 204 application reviews for peace officers, 29 reviews for waiver and reactivations, 42 reviews for dispatcher applications, for a total of 276. We have 67 active investigations that we're currently monitoring, and 99 total for all the process, whether they're out for some type of review, either waiting for waivers or whatever the process might be at that point. So that's where we're at. Any questions for the Investigations Bureau? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lieutenant Acosta. All right, we'll move forward to the Satellite Academy audits. Yes. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. almost skipped you.
Thank you, Chairman. So regarding the Post-Council Training Bureau first quarter report, in the Basic Training Division, Class 311 graduated on February 26, with 26 cadets receiving their law enforcement certification. On February 5th, Class 312 started their SFO block, and they started with 19. 17 continued on into the law enforcement block. Two of those cadets withdrew for personal reasons. So 312 is currently in the law enforcement block with 32 cadets, and they are scheduled to graduate April 23rd of this year. Class 313 started on February 23rd, and they're currently in the SFO block with 14 cadets. Any questions regarding the basic training before I move on to the in-service training report? In service, this year, for the first quarter, from January until the end of March, POST has offered 29 in-service training classes. We trained 664 peace officers along with dispatchers as well. That number includes the dispatcher training, for a total of 468 hours of training. Any questions regarding the in-service training report or the basic training report? Is it okay to move on to the next part?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So this quarter, we conducted 2 administrative audits. The first administrative audit was Salt Lake City Police Department. And if you recall, last year, we did have one exception to their audit, and that was regarding the training of defensive tactics. We found that there was some difference in the way that they were conducting their defensive tactics training along with the state curriculum versus the Salt Lake City curriculum that they teach side by side. We got that worked out, and pleased to announce that this year for the administrative audit, there are no exceptions to the Salt Lake City audit. The second audit that was conducted was through the Utah Department of Corrections, and there were also no exceptions to that audit. Any questions regarding either of the Satellite Academy audits? Okay, I did want to just report that some occasionally outside of the regularly scheduled audits will receive issues maybe regarding policy and procedure. And one such matter did occur regarding the Weber State Police Academy training. It was determined that three of their cadets were allowed to train or to move on from the special functions officer block of training into the law enforcement officer block of training before passing the special functions officer PT test. And what that creates is a little bit of an issue because when they go to take their certification exam at the end of the training block, they're not able to become certified until they have passed their physical fitness training program. So that's the reason why the policy says you shall not allow the cadet to continue to train from one block to the other until they've met the minimum requirements for the special functions officer block of training. We've met with the Weber State Academy director, Jack Rickards, and he understands that now, and we feel confident that we shouldn't have that pop up in the future or that problem exist. Any questions regarding that? Any of the Satellite Academy or the policy procedures? Okay. So did you want me to stay up here for the next part of that?
Yes,
talk
please.
About the dog training program. So just so you're not confused with what's on the agenda, this is not a police canine training program that we're going to ask that the council allow us to conduct a pilot training program for. This is a program that was developed through the COPS training program, the division of the Department of Justice that develops curriculum through government grants. And we feel like we could produce, in conjunction with this curriculum and use their objectives, a fairly good, substantial 1 to 2 hour block to inoculate, so to speak, or to introduce new officers coming through the academy of how to recognize dog behavior and then also respond to that and give some appropriate ways to respond to dogs, because obviously officers are encountering dogs every day on the job. What's interesting is when we met with Salt Lake City during their audit, they actually taught this same curriculum in their in-service training program this year, and it was received very well. And so that was kind of nice to hear that it is already out there amongst a lot of the law enforcement agencies anyway, and so we thought, why don't we include this in the basic training program? So we would like to ask that the council allow us to produce this pilot program, and then in June we would be ready to give the council an outline of what we would like to actually implement into the curriculum for statewide academies to teach. So I would like to entertain any questions regarding this, any issues that the council may have regarding this training that we would like to implement into the curriculum.
When you've developed the curriculum, then when would you actually look at implementing it? Sometime?
We would like to bring this before the post council in the next meeting, which would be in June. And then it would go into an effect July 1. Okay. So all classes that started after July 1, when the new curriculum would go into effect, they would be the ones that actually would be teaching this. And at first, we'd like to try it in the special functions officer block of the training. That means all officers statewide would receive this training. It may make sense after we've done the pilot program that it goes into the law enforcement block. It may make sense that it stays in the special functions officer block.
What about in-service training for those who might want that?
I think if the need exists, Sheriff, we would definitely like to push this out. This curriculum is about 6 to 8 hours long. We weren't sure that it meant that it would be effective to do all 6 to 8 hours in the basic training block. That's an extra whole day in the academy nearly. So if there's agencies that feel like they may need a 6 to 8 hour training block or the 4 hour block, which might be a little bit more appropriate. And I think what makes it so long is there are several videos that this Department of Justice have produced that you don't have to show all of them. We felt like there was two or three of them that were really good, about 4 to 5 minutes long, that shows different dog behaviors and then how to react to those behaviors. as an officer. And you wouldn't have to use everything that they've produced. But if you did use it, it's a full day of training.
Thank you.
Do you want to vote? You need a motion.
I think we would be seeking for a vote to be able to allow this pilot program to go forward. And then we would present the final findings of the pilot program in the June meeting.
All right. Request for a motion.
I'd make a motion to adopt the training program as proposed.
Second.
A motion. A second. Chief Burbank. We have a second. Any discussion? Further discussion? I think it's something that's timely
with the current feelings in the communities about their animals. It's always been an issue. All right, thank you. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
All right, we'll move forward on to administrative rule proposal. Director Stevenson.
Thank you, Chair. With your permission, I would like to talk about the other rules before getting into the non-reporting administrative rule. As per statute, when it comes to administrative rule, I have the authority to make a rule, but I'm required to come and ask for consent and advice from the council when we make an administrative rule change. After this body hears my proposals, and it'll be submitted through the administrative rulemaking process, which requires it to be submitted for 30 days review for public review and comment, and then after that it goes into effect. There are several rules that we are creating, most of it out of necessity because there's a lot of redundancy within the old administrative rule. So we're combining a lot of rules that just don't make sense to be standalone. But I want to point out a few, one being the canine body armor, which is a new rule. We now have the authority to start offering grants to departments to purchase canine body armor. And there's a procedural process that needs to be fulfilled to be able to release those monies. So we want to get that information out to the departments so they can start making requests for body armor purchase. The other one is the minimum standards for emergency vehicle operations. If you remember, several years ago, by statute, we were required to formulate a base model for pursuits, which most departments have to meet that minimum standard, but most of you and the other departments throughout the state exceed that minimum standard, but by statute we're required to have that in place. Any questions about the administrative rules?
There were quite a few of them, and I think you've probably been able to go over them with the opportunity to look at some of the replacements or some of the deletions. Do we need to accept those by, or are they just going to be moved forward if there is
I'm just presenting them to okay. you, and if you have any advice, please offer it. Okay, moving on. The next administrative rule is failure to report for administrators on officer misconduct. This has been a much discussed topic. I think the administrative rule process is the best route. I submitted this proposal to both associations and have only received probably a handful of recommendations and feedback. You see some of the words are struck out. That's because of some of the feedback I received. This is just a working document, but I'd also like to engender former Post Director Sid Grohl to give us a historical perspective, and then also Sheriff Tracy, since he attended some of the meetings that we might wanted to have some discussion. But before we go into that, with your permission, I'd like to have Sid Grohl come up and speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Council, let me, some of you don't know me, most of you do, give you a little history of my background. I worked for the Cache County Sheriff's Office for about 23 years, beginning in 1973, and was able to be on the post council for a number of years, beginning in, I think, 86. Came to be the director of post in 97, worked through 2004. That gives you a little bit of history of where I come from to be able to talk to you today. The statute that we're talking about has been in place for all of that time, pretty much, and has been concerning, I think, for administrators across the state. It's a challenge and has been for years in the post council and for administrators to balance fair and equal. I think the post council has come a long ways in becoming equal, and I think administrators fight with fairness. And I think administrators believe that some of the administrative rules that they put in place in their agencies have satisfied the need for discipline internally. So as we look at the statute that says the administrator shall report those items that are in post policy and state law, it's important to do that. While I was at post as the chairman and of the council and also as a director, we saw a few occasions when agencies did not report. And there was both sides of the equation, I think, that they didn't report. On one side, it was minimal. They thought that they conducted administrative rules and such internally that dealt discipline internally and didn't have to come to post. On the other side, it was major issues that they didn't want to bring them to post, that had to be major disciplines. And so I saw both of those equations that occurred. I think what Scott's trying to do, the director is trying to do, is bring a balance of assurance that those things that need to come to post based on statute should come. And I recommend that you follow the guidelines that he's put forward, and we all need as administrators to be accountable for that. I currently serve as a director of law enforcement for the Department of Natural Resources, and we try in all of those circumstances, and some of those areas are minor, but they fit the statute, and I bring them before you. I think every agency ought to be held to some accountability to bring those pieces for you as according to state law. And so I just speak in that historical perspective of what I've seen over the years, and it's still a challenge. And I give accolades to the director to try and bring this to a logical conclusion that we have our administrators be accountable for that. Thank you.
Now, if I may add before we go into discussion, just since I've been director, from what I have seen and what I'm able to prove, it is not a big problem. It rises from time to time, and I anticipate this administrative rule being used, you know, one to two times every couple of years. I think we've done a better job of educating the law enforcement community, our administrators, about post role and what constitutes something that needs to be reported to post. And I think that really that's was the issue, is just knowing what is going on and what needs to be reported. And I think we're turning that corner. But I have a lot of communication with administrators throughout the state asking me questions about, okay, is this something that needs to be required as far as reporting purposes go? So I'd like to encourage that, but I think there needs to be something in place so there are checks and balances between this body and the law enforcement community. So, Sheriff Tracy, do you have anything?
We do. Some of this discussion came up during the LELC session, and there was some interesting points that were brought up. I'd like to just basically turn the time over to Chief Carpenter here for a second and discuss some of those issues for consideration.
Director Stevenson, I appreciate you reaching out to the chiefs and sheriffs and DPS associations so that we could have this discussion during LELC, which we did do. We spoke about that. As you stated, there's always some concern as to what is reportable, what is not, what is handled administratively. Out of that conversation, we had several chiefs and sheriffs recommend that the first letter the first dealing with an agency should be a letter of caution requiring the chief law enforcement official to respond to the concerns of post with a full response as to, you know, what the issues were. Secondly, if this occurs again, then of course the administrative rule would kick in and they would appear before post council to make explanation. I think, as you stated, we're in an education process for some of the chiefs and sheriffs and other law enforcement officials I've always had great success in calling post and having good direction as to how to proceed with that. And I feel that we need to be accountable and that we do need that level of transparency. Thank you.
So I added an initial sanction because a letter of counsel or caution is considered a sanction. We would need to go through the formal adjudicative process administrative rule. So that would come before this council to vote for a sustain or not. And I don't know if the discussion was in anticipation of avoiding it coming before the council the first time.
I think the first time was so that you would contact the agency. The agency would then respond as to, and then we'd bring that before this body and have explanation. If they failed to respond or there was an additional instance, they would fall into place before the administrative rule. I don't know how we would. Right. I'm just bringing that back to you. That was their input.
So, Marcus, we would need to come up with some language so that I'm aware of the violation. Okay.
If I may, I'm going to disagree a little bit. I mean, we hold our police officers to a very high standard, and part of what we see across the nation now is the fact that accountability does not exist in some locations. If we're going to allow, it's not that hard, right? Err on the side of calling post or sending it to post and then have post tell you, you know what, we're not going to pursue this one for whatever reason, and then you're fine. And then there's consistency, there's accountability, and then when the public comes calling and asks, why did you not, well, no, we sent it, right? This body wants to review and have the ability to say, yes, peace officers in this state are held to this standard across the board. I think that sends a much better message to the public.
I guess that my other question is a letter of caution actually would be more of a sanction than what's it actually sitting in the language currently. Is that correct?
Correct. As proposed, when we identify and are able to prove that this occurred, then we would present this to the council. And the law enforcement administrator would be required to attend and explain why that occurred to this council.
My last question then would be, if that happened and somebody came before post and explained that, at what point in time are the options that the council would take? Are there sanctions that could be imposed? Are there where can this council go or not go based on a report from an administrator if there was a failure to report?
And council jump in. But from our discussions, to add a sanction, then we would have to go with my original choice of changing statute. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And we all know how that
went. Where that can go.
All right. So what you have right now is you just have it on a record in this meeting where that agency had to show up and give an explanation, and then we just have that record. That's pretty much it.
Okay. So do I understand if we went with this rule and a chief came and explained why he or she didn't report, and if it wasn't a satisfactory answer, then a letter of caution could not be issued or could be. It seems to me that the letter of caution should follow the explanation rather than a letter of caution first. I don't know that. We need statutory language for that.
I think it's considered a sanction, then I think we would, but I'm going to acquiesce to the council.
Well, there's no weight behind that letter of caution, other than you now have a record, going on record saying, we didn't like your explanation.
It's kind of an embarrassment factor for a chief or a sheriff.
That's exactly what it is. It's an embarrassment factor, but there's no actual sanction.
I guess if there was a pattern that was developed, then after that, let's say there was a third and a fourth, I mean, at what point would you do something that would be more than a letter of sanction? Could you move that into the regular process of bringing that individual before post for a consideration of a sanction underneath the post-disciplinary guidelines? Is that what you would do? That's my question. I mean, if it didn't cease, how would you adjudicate that?
I think as it stands, there would be no progressive sanctioning capability by the council unless we changed
statute
and added a sanction to the current law.
Okay. again, you're bringing this to us for our advice.
Just advice, opinion. You know, I don't want to put out a bad administrative rule, but I thought if we had something in place to see how it plays out, educate and notify all the administrators, and really that's where I think the problem is occurring, is just a lack of knowledge about what they should and should not report. And get it out there and then see how it works, and then we can revisit it in a year.
Comment, Mr. Bailey?
In both sections it says shall report and shall appear. Is there any concern somebody won't comply? Is there anything that can be done?
There's always that concern, yes.
Is there anything that can be done if they just don't?
No. We'd have to change statute to add any formal sanction.
And if I may address really quick, if we had that concern, we would at that time, that would give us enough information to go to the legislature and say, this is where we need a sanction because we don't have any force behind this. So right now, this is just pretty much a slap on the wrist. Hey, you need to report this to us. But if we have that, we can use that as evidence to the legislature.
Thank you.
Which might be the best way to go, because we don't want a bill looking for a home that we don't need. I think that, you know, if we don't have a huge issue with this, maybe this is a good way to start. And as a starting point, and if we see that we have a problem as post council, I think it would be appropriate at that point to push something forward.
This also creates a mechanism that requires and compels me to bring it before this body, so you're aware of how many times it occurs.
Thank you.
Again,
I know that we wouldn't be a motion. Are you looking for a vote of support for either the first option or the second? Or
yes, a vote of support would be nice.
All right, we have then two options. We have the proposed rule as written, or the other option of having a letter of caution sent. Let's go ahead and take a vote. All those who are supportive of the rule as it is written in the outline that you have before you, say aye.
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 Any opposed? I think you have your answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director. All right. We'll move into the disciplinary actions and start that with Assistant AG Marcus Yockey. One of the few uninjured staff that can stand.
Okay, so let's get started on this. The first matter before the council is a certification of Jason Adams. He is a former member of the Washington County Sheriff's Office. Sustained allegations are DUI with passengers under the age of 16, which falls under Category B of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a 4-year suspension. And the summary of the facts are as follows. On February 9th, 2014, Jason Adams was involved in a traffic accident off-duty in his unmarked department-issued vehicle. Adams' 4 children were inside the vehicle, all under the age of 16, and all sustained minor injuries. When police and medical personnel arrived, Adams was asked to perform standardized field sobriety tests, which indicated impairment. A subsequent blood draw determined Adams' blood alcohol content was 0.24 grams per milliliter of blood, 3 times the legal limit. In Garrity interviews with Internal Affairs and with Post, Adams admitted to drinking alcohol prior to driving. Adams stated that he should not have been behind the wheel and admitted to having an alcohol problem. Adams resigned from his employment on March 11, 2014. On November 21, 2014, Adams pled guilty to a DUI, a Class A misdemeanor. On November 24, 2014, Adams waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Mr. Adams, are you here? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the council, I'm Brett Rawson, attorney for respondent. I have stood before you on a number of occasions for DUI cases, and I don't recall ever saying to you that I've been proud of a client in the way that they have conducted themselves after an incident such as this one. In this case, I certainly am proud of my client and the way that he has conducted himself. I did not recognize my client when I walked in this morning because he's lost 50 pounds. And he'll tell you that the reason why he's lost 50 pounds is because he quit drinking. I don't recall a time that I've been able to stand before you and suggest to you that a client has completely abstained from alcohol in the way that this officer has. He has done that. There are some other things that bear upon his character, and he will have an opportunity here to speak with you. I'll be brief. But some things that bear upon his character, which I think that you should know. I was not his attorney for the criminal matter out of St. George, but this is what I understand about it. I understand that there was a point in that case that it became appropriate to file a motion to suppress. And in that motion, to call into question the activities of his brothers and sisters in blue, and even perhaps their credibility. My client refused to do that. My client refused to take a plea agreement. My client was made an example of and put into jail in St. George. He served 2 weeks. During the time that he was in there, the news broke that he was serving time, and it became very difficult for reasons which I'm sure that you understand. I understand that he got a day off for good behavior, was released after 13 days. He has done everything that a person can do to correct what occurred. Now, Post is recommending 4 years, and the reason why they're recommending 4 years are because of the aggravating circumstances of kids in the car. I have stood here before you before on occasions where there have been accidents, where there have been injuries, and I have provided statistics to you from time to time regarding how much time off you've given officers in certain situations. I can tell you I do not recall, even in the accident cases where there were injuries, anybody getting 4 years, at least those that I have represented. I believe that a more appropriate sanction for this officer is in the neighborhood of 2 years. He is 40 years old. Bringing him back at 44 to go to police academy, I believe, serves no real purpose other than additional punitive measures. And I would submit to you that additional punitive measures are not needed in this circumstance for this officer. I'll stand for questions, but before that, I'll have my client address you.
Thank you. I'll be brief. I just wanted to to acknowledge that, excuse me, that you are some of the most important members of the law enforcement community here in Utah, and the jobs that you're doing are very important. And I appreciate the forum that I have to kind of speak to the law enforcement community as I am. I want to take this opportunity to tell you how very, very sorry I am for the mistakes that I've made and the way that it is reflected upon the Washington County Sheriff's Office. I know that the mistakes that I made, it was not a single mistake. It was a decision that I made day after day to deal with stress through alcohol. I want to tell you guys that I am grateful that all that I lost was my career. I'm grateful that I didn't hurt my kids, and God forbid if I had hurt somebody else. I am so sorry that I made such a terrible decision. But now I'm making a decision every day to be an example for what to do, not be an example for what not to do. And that's really a result of the opportunities and experiences that I have gained through law enforcement. So I am so thankful that I had 16 years in law enforcement, the opportunities and the relationships that I was allowed to have. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Adams from the council?
I have one. Okay. Council, the last document I had indicates that the charges were still pending. Have they been cleared up?
He'd been resolved. He did plead guilty, and he did serve his time.
What did he plead to?
DUI.
A or B?
A.
Okay. We'll turn time back over to Mr. Yockey.
And just as a quick rebuttal, Chairman, in regards to the statistics, we just haven't verified those, so I'd just like to bring that up to light. In regards to the aggravating circumstances, the reason Post is looking for 4 years is it's multiple faceted. It's because there's both children in the vehicle and because of the high blood alcohol content, which was 3 times the legal limit. All right.
Thank you. Bring this matter back to the council for discussion or a motion.
Make a motion.
All right.
Motion that we recommend the 4-year suspension.
All right, we have a motion for the 4-year suspension. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion?
Yeah, if I could have a little discussion time, I think it's worth, as I look down the list, and I am certainly not minimizing the DUI, and especially with the children in the car, but you have possession of a controlled substance and 2 counts of theft that are only earning a 3-year suspension. You have theft that's a 1-year suspension. Lying under Garrity in several circumstances are only 2-year suspensions. And again, while I don't want to minimize a DUI, I do have some problems saying that that rises to that much higher than possession of a controlled substance and 2 counts of theft. I mean, you've got some serious offenses that are occurring here. And again, not to minimize what's been done here, but I have to ask why, because I tend to think, as I've looked at DUI cases in the past, 2 years or even a 3-year for aggravating circumstances has come up, but I don't know that I recall seeing the 4-year.
Okay, the point of clarification.
Point of clarification, the line under Gary is revocation.
Yes, revocation.
Oh, I'm...
Yeah, that's...
Do we know what the standard has been, Director, DUI with injury class A?
I'd have to pull the historical records. I don't know off the top of my head. We look at the guidelines that have been passed, and if there are aggravators, we look at the totality of the circumstances. We can't look at 4 years. Again, this council, I'm not stepping on both of your issues. You guys can go against the guidelines. It is your prerogative. But you did vote to support that, and my staff, myself, we adhere strictly to the guidelines that have been approved by this body.
Chair, may I make a comment? The reason for my recommendation, as I recall, and I don't have this before me today, is a very a lieutenant in the Utah Highway Patrol who was also crashed his car for a DUI offense with no children in the car, also a very high BAC, and I believe it was a 4-year suspension on that one because of the high profileness of the case. Although Mr. Adams wasn't a lieutenant with Washington County Sheriff's Office, children in the car, 4 children in the car, 2-4 DUI level, in a patrol car, to that seems to me a 4-year suspension, based on what we've done in the past with the one case I can refer in my mind.
All right, thank you. Any further discussion?
I would just like to comment that I'm very impressed with the improvement, the change that we have seen with Mr. Adams. And I think also at some point we need to recognize that as police officers. Police officers deal with a lot of challenging things with a lot of stress. And I don't forgive what he's done here. But I think we also have to talk about at what point in time do we recognize the significant improvements that these officers have made.
Thank you.
We do have a motion on the table. Is there a substitute motion or is there an entertainment for a substitute motion?
As currently motion, we have 4-year suspension. Correction. Yes, suspension. And a second.
I'll try a motion. I would move that be reduced to a 3-year suspension, that absolutely the 2 years for the DUI and then the aggravation because of the alcohol content and the children in the car, but I don't know that it rises to a 3-year suspension.
I'll second.
Or a 4-year.
All right, we have 2 motions. And let's go to the first motion for a vote.
No. Vote on the substitute.
Sorry. No. Is that correct?
Substitute.
Okay, substitute. We can do the substitute. All right. Make sure we got it right here.
We have the substitute motion again. It would be, to clarify, Chief?
It would be a 3-year suspension.
Okay. 3-year suspension. All right. Any further discussion? Do we have a second on that?
I'll second that.
Okay. Chief Stratton. Any further discussion? All those in favor of a 3-year suspension rather than a 4, as seconded, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Nay.
Nay. Nay. All right. I think we let's go ahead and have a hand vote. All those in favor with a hand up. Okay, and all those opposed?
7-4.
7-4. Okay, rule 7-4, that the motion does pass and will be changed to a 3-year suspension. Thank you. Next case.
The next matter before the council is the certification of Sean P. Brent. He is a former member of the Weber County Sheriff's Office. Sustained allegations are criminal mischief, deviant in the presence of a child, damage, interruption of a communication device, and disorderly conduct, which falls under Category D of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a 1-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On January 22, 2014, Sean Brent was involved in a verbal argument with his wife. During the argument, Brent damaged several items within the home. Brent's 11-year-old son attempted to call 911 at his mother's request, but Brent pulled the phone cord from the wall. Brent's stepson then ran to the neighbor's home to summon police. During the argument, Brent's infant son was in a car seat in an adjacent room. When police arrived, Brent admitted to breaking several items as well as pulling the phone cord from the wall. Brent was later charged with criminal mischief and interruption of a communication device, both Class B misdemeanors. Brent entered a guilty plea, which was held in abeyance and amended to a charge of disorderly conduct, a Class C misdemeanor. The charge for interrupting a communication device was dismissed. During Garrity interviews with Internal Affairs and Post, Brent admitted he intentionally pulled the phone cord from the wall when his stepson attempted to call 911. Brent also admitted he broke several items within his home during the argument. On February 19, 2014, Brent resigned from his employment. On March 4, 2015, Brent waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
All right, thank you. Is Mr. Brent here or his counsel? Okay, would you please go ahead and approach?
I'll be brief. I just want to thank the council for your time, and I'm just here to tell the council that I truly regret my actions of January 22, 2014. I was very careless in my actions that day, and I regret bringing shame to my agency, Weber County Sheriff's Office, as well. I fully understand that I threw away almost 15 years in service as a correctional officer for the Weber County Sheriff's Office and 3 years as a first-line supervisor. I was a corporal. I have, I think about this, the decisions I made that day, each and every day. And I've taken some steps to try to improve, make some self-improvements and to which would include I've enrolled in a domestic violence course at Weber Human Services, and my wife and I have been involved in couples therapy to work on some of our marital issues as well. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's all about the decision that I've made and not repeating the mistakes that I've made in the past. And so I'm here to ask the council to give me the opportunity to return to the profession that I so dearly love sometime in the future. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Brent from the council? All
right. Nothing in rebuttal.
Okay, nothing in rebuttal. All right, we'll return to the council for a motion or discussion.
Discussion. How do we get to Category D offense on this? I'm looking at multiple Class B misdemeanors, possibly even Class A. Are we going off just what it pled to or what the actual charges are or the facts of the charges?
In regards to Category D, it's their Class B misdemeanors. In regards to nonviolent situations, there was no assault or anything like that. In regards to this, this was pulling a phone cord and domestic violence in the presence of a child for the pulling of the phone cord.
All right, thank you. Any other discussion, questions?
Just clarification, there was no physical threats, is that correct?
As far as we could see, no.
Thank you.
Again, as far as our investigation turned out.
All right. Looking to the council for a motion.
Make a motion to accept the 1-year suspension.
Then we have a motion and a second.
Second.
And a second. We have a motion to accept the 1-year suspension as recommended and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Next case.
The next matter before the council is the certification of Rebecca Alberts. She was not employed at the time of the offense. Sustained allegations of willfully falsifying information to obtain certification, which falls under Category C of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a 2-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On June 18, 2013, Rebecca Burtz submitted an application to POST to attend the police academy. Burtz indicated her only involvement in any criminal activity was periodically smoking marijuana between the ages of 15 and 19. On July 25, 2013, Burtz submitted a post-verification information form with no addendum attached. On July 31, 2013, Burtz submitted an addendum disclosing she had witnessed her friends conduct multiple drug transactions involving marijuana and methamphetamine. On December 3, 2013, Burtz submitted another addendum disclosing that while filling out a background check for a local agency, she remembered she and her ex-husband had a marijuana plant. In addition, Burtz admitted she had driven under the influence of alcohol and harvested mushrooms for her friends to sell. Post was unable to contact Burtz for an interview. Rebecca Burtz failed to respond to the notice of agency action, and on December 9, 2014, an order of default was signed by an administrative law judge and mailed to Rebecca Burtz.
Thank you. Is Rebecca Burtz or her counsel here? All right. Seeing none, I'll go ahead and refer this back to the council for a motion.
Can I just ask a question? This was not a whoops, I forgot to fill out line 14 because I didn't remember all this in my life. This is. I failed to see the difference between that type of falsification of information and anything that you would say under Garrity. And why we would ever want somebody in our profession who is going to intentionally lie about an application in order to get. I don't know why we would only go that lie to suspension on this. And this is all, just so you know, it has always been an issue for me, right? It's one thing to lie under Garrity, but, I mean, our expectation is that you don't ever lie and deceive anybody. And why would we ever start somebody down the road or give them an opportunity once they've demonstrated this behavior in the future?
Any other discussion? I'll look for a motion.
Make a motion to accept.
All right, we have a motion to accept the 2-year suspension. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Second. Any further discussion?
Do we have the ability to make, I mean, given our guidelines? I mean, is it,
That's the question I just
asked. I'm looking kind of for an attorney opinion on this one. As it may mean a bigger discussion about how we consider this type of misconduct in the future. Because, again, I really struggle with the fact that if I call you in an intention and say, okay, I'm asking you a question, but then I give you a document that I say, okay, I expect you to tell the truth on this, which every one of those forms says that, right?
You signed.
How is there a difference between that and the Garrity statement? And so, I mean, I would certainly be looking more towards a revocation of an opportunity to even apply to law enforcement, given the fact that there is very little difference between those two standards.
I guess the one would require that we change the matrix and put that under a different category, which we at some point can discuss, I'm assuming.
Well, isn't the matrix a guideline?
And again, but I just asked Director Stevenson, he said that we could go further than what's recommended based on the guideline, but in the issue of consistency, that's where they put the recommendation based on where it falls currently.
These are your guidelines to give us a working document so that we know what is fair and what is consistent. So this body has discretion to go outside the group guidelines.
So, as not to prolong the meeting anymore, I won't get invited back. I would certainly move in this circumstance to make this a revocation, given the fact that it is on a statement that we expect, or on a piece of paper that we expect you to tell the truth. I don't see the difference between Garrity, and then I would ask that this council review in the future reclassifying this in our matrix as a more serious offense.
So that is a substitute motion? Or?
Yes, please.
Let's do two things here. I guess I'd like to know eventually when would it be, do we need to put this on the agenda for next time to discuss this? That may be something that we, according to Chief Burbank, we would like to do. We also have a substitute motion here for, is that revocation, Chief?
Yes.
Right. Was there something that you would like to say? All right.
We need two motions, correct.
Right. We have two motions, but, well, we have a substitute motion. We can vote on the substitute motion. So we have the substitute to change this 2-year to a revocation. Do we have a second on that?
Second.
We have a second. All right. All those in favor to change the 2-year to a revocation, say aye.
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 All those opposed?
Aye.
Okay. We'll vote unanimous that it was changed to revocation. Before we move on, secondly, would you like to make that an issue topic for next time?
I would very much like to. So my motion would be that we ask Post to review this and present and council consider upping this as far as on application to be the same as a Garrity statement.
If I could add, I want to participate in the discussions because I'm ready to do so, but I want you to bear in mind that, yeah, we all know probably based upon the information that it was done intentionally. But there are a lot of these situations where it's very difficult to get that absolute, I did this. And so we're left to speculate. And the 2 years has been consistent with what the guidelines have been approved, and that's why we came to you with a 2-year recommendation. But keep in mind, we see these situations, and we're like, come on. But again, unless we get, I did this, and we're able to prove distinctly that this occurred, it's very hard to prove whether somebody did intentionally or...
Well, and not to be argumentative, but in the case where somebody fills out an application that comes back and says, oh yeah, I'm changing my mind on this, or files a different application, which I've experienced firsthand with another agency or with Post and what they filled out with me, there's some intent there. And so certainly, in those circumstances, again, you can say, oh yeah, you know, line 14, I didn't quite understand that, and so I didn't answer that I'd never gotten a speeding ticket before, right? Then that would be a mitigating circumstance for Post to consider and could certainly reduce that given our guidelines, just like we can enhance it. But I think the seriousness of this certainly, as for the well-being of our profession, deserves consideration.
Sure. Do we need that in a motion to put it on the next agenda or just a suggestion?
We'll just put it on the next agenda.
I just think the fact that it's multiple times, it wasn't just somebody making a mistake or forgetful once. It's multiple, so that, I think, takes along that 2-year suspension, which I think normally is a good rule.
Yeah.
I think this would be an appropriate topic for next time to discuss.
I don't like to dredge up old history, but years ago when I chaired POST, my first meeting, we had a person intentionally lied on their application. The recommendation was a 2-year suspension, and the council came back with about a 6-month suspension because they liked the individual. Now, I think we better be consistent on what we do. Frankly, I think if you lie, you lie. If you can establish an intentional falsehood on your application, I don't see how that's any different than Garrity.
I think that's something we can discuss for next time as a sanction range that goes into where it falls within that matrix. That would be a good discussion.
Director, is there a requirement for Garrity to be read, or could it be included on the bottom of the statement?
Well, you don't.
Then push it into the next.
But you don't always have people go sworn and fill out their application.
So
they would not fall into the
fruit.
They wouldn't get Gary for an application.
Right. Okay. All right, thank you. We'll intend on discussing that next time then. Thank you. All right, next case.
The next matter before the council is certification of Justin L. Curtis. He is a former member of the Cache County Sheriff's Office. Sustained allegations are theft by deception, which falls under Category D of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a 1-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. During September 2007, while attending a police academy qualification shoot, Curtis took a case of .40 caliber ammunition that was left over after the final shoot. Later, during the summer of 2011, Curtis attended a department-sponsored firearms training. As a range master, Curtis was in charge of bringing ammunition to the range, then returning the unused ammunition to the department armory. At the conclusion of the training, a box of 1,000 rounds of .223 rifle ammunition fell behind some plastic totes in the trunk of Curtis's patrol vehicle. Later, while cleaning his vehicle, he found the case of ammunition and placed it in a conspicuous place in his garage to help him remember to take it back to the armory. In the fall of 2013, Curtis, being short on money, took both cases to a local pawn shop and sold the ammunition. Some of the boxes had markings from the police academy, and the pawn shop owner contacted local police. Curtis participated in his agency internal investigation as well as in criminal investigation by another agency. Curtis was subsequently charged with 2 counts of theft by deception. On February 5, 2014, during a post-Garrity interview, Curtis admitted to the theft of ammunition in 2011, but claimed that the ammunition he took in September of 2007 while at the academy was given to the cadet by staff. On September 11, 2014, Officer Justin Curtis waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
All right, thank you. Is Mr. Curtis or his counsel here? All right, I see no one representing him. I'll bring it back to the board for the motion.
Okay,
we have a motion to accept the 1-year suspension. Second. Second. All those in favor of accepting the 1-year suspension, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. That passes. Next case.
The next matter before the council is the certification of Tony Ewell. He is a former member of the Summit County Sheriff's Office. Sustained allegations are possession of controlled substance and 2 counts of theft, which falls under Category C and D of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a 3-year suspension based on the amount of sustained allegations. A summary of the facts are as follows. On January 12, 2014, Tony Ewell was working in the jail at the Summit County Sheriff's Office. Ewell took 22 pills of 100 milligram tramadol, a Schedule 5 narcotic, from the medication cart in the jail. On January 21st, 2014, during an internal investigation, Ewell admitted to having an addiction to pain medication and to taking the tramadol. Ewell resigned from the Summit County Sheriff's Office on January 21st, 2014. Criminal charges were not filed in relation to this incident. On February 18th, 2014, Tony Ewell was arrested in a local department store for retail theft. Ewell was seen by security personnel placing toys inside a plastic bag taken from inside his jacket. Ewell was observed leaving the store and not paying for the items. When arrested, Ewell was wearing a cap and jacket with Summit County Sheriff's Department logos embroidered on them.
Yule told security personnel and the arresting officer that he was a law enforcement officer. The arresting officer confirmed with the Summit County Sheriff's Office that Yule was no longer an employee with their agency. Yule was arrested for the retail theft and impersonating an officer. The impersonating an officer charge was not filed by the state. On August 14, 2014, Officer Yule was mailed a notice of agency action. Officer Yule failed to respond to a notice of agency action. And on November 19, 2014, Officer Yule was mailed a motion for entry of default. On December 9, 2014, an order of default was signed by the judge and mailed to Officer Yule.
All right, thank you. Mr. Yule or his counsel here? All right, I see no one representing him. I'll bring it back to the council for a motion.
Motion to accept the 3-year suspension.
Okay, a motion to accept 3-year suspension. Second?
Second.
And a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Next case.
The next matter before the council is the certification of Zachary R. Hunt. He is a former member of the Department of Public Safety. Sustained allegations are falsifying a post application, which falls under Category C of the post disciplinary guidelines. Post recommended disciplinary action is a 2-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. In February of 2012, Zachary Hunt submitted an application to post for dispatcher certification. Hunt failed to disclose in the application that on two occasions in October 2010, Hunt, who was then age 17, performed oral sex on a male friend who was age 14. In January 2013, the male friend disclosed the sexual conduct as part of his therapy at a youth substance abuse rehabilitation center. A criminal investigation was conducted, and the case was ultimately adjudicated in juvenile court. In June 2013, the Department of Public Safety conducted an internal investigation and determined the sexual conduct was consensual. During a post-Garrity interview, it was discovered Hunt failed to disclose the sexual misconduct on his February 2012 post-application. On September 15, 2014, Mr. Zachary Hunt waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Thank you. Is Mr. Hunt or his counsel here? All right. I see no one representing him. I'll bring it back to the council for a motion.
I'm going to recuse myself.
Okay. Carl Fuhrer will recuse himself. Looking for a motion.
To accept the recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion to accept the recommendation. We have a second.
Second.
And a second. Any further discussion?
I apologize, but I don't know how this is any different again. He fails to disclose this on an application that says, put everything on here that you would know. And he's willing to tell you in a Garrity interview and does at a later time, but doesn't do up front. There's some intention to lie. And that is insulting to this profession. I would move that it be revocation.
Okay, I'm making a substitute motion for revocation.
Yes, I apologize. Yes.
Is there a second?
I would second it based on consistency with the previous case.
Okay, we have a second based on the previous case for consistency.
The previous one, there were multiple.
Yeah, there were multiple. Right, but we haven't defined the rents.
We have not. That's something that comes
up. The hard spot.
Again, each case is independent.
Fact rich.
That's correct. Take the facts of the case.
Multiple opportunities.
My concern with this one would be you're talking about a consensual encounter between, while it's illegal, the other one was multiple drug offenses. I just see it differently.
All right. We still have a substitute motion for 4-year and a second, or excuse me, for revocation and a second. Let's go ahead and vote on that substitute motion. All those in favor for revocation, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
Nay.
All right, let's have the hands. All those in favor? I would say just 3 of us. And all those opposed, please raise your hand. All right, that motion fails. We'll go back to the first motion. We have a motion to accept the 2-year suspension and a second. Any further discussion?
All those in favor of that motion and the second, the 2-year suspension, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Nay.
Yes. So we got three opposed.
Three. I've
got two. I'm not voting, am I? Yeah, that's right. All right. That second motion, the 2-year suspension, does pass. Next case.
The next matter before the council is certification of Michael Pope. He's a former member of the Utah Highway Patrol. Sustained allegations are domestic violence assault and domestic violence in the presence of a child, which falls under Category C of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a two-and-a-half-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On August 15, 2013, Michael Pope was informed by his wife that she was having an affair, an extramarital affair. During an ensuing argument, Pope slapped his wife in the face with an open hand. Pope notified a Utah Highway Patrol supervisor who notified local police. Pope was arrested and charged with misdemeanor domestic violence offenses. Pope later entered a diversion agreement with the court. Pope admitted to the assault and domestic violence in the presence of a child in Garrity interviews with both UHP and Post. On November 8, 2013, Pope was terminated from the Utah Highway Patrol. On February 16, 2015, Pope waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
All right. Is Mr. Pope here or his counsel?
Greg Scorda, I'm sorry.
State your name, please.
I'm Michael Pope. Greg Scorda is my attorney. Got caught up in court, so he won't be here today. My reason for coming before you is I wanted to give you a little bit of a background of what happened. Pretty much almost the whole 10 years that I worked for Highway Patrol, I worked 2 and sometimes 3 jobs to try to support my wife and my family. And in the process of doing that, I guess I neglected my wife emotionally, and I think we both just, I guess, lost appreciation for each other. Having said that, though, this chain of events all occurred because of another officer who was a family friend for a few years. My wife and his wife were practically best friends. Our daughters were best friends, played comp soccer together, and our boys played together. So I don't know, maybe I'm stupid. Maybe, you know, I guess I kind of, maybe I saw things. I just didn't, you know, think, because I trusted him as a fellow brother in blue, and I had pretty much 100% trust in my wife. I want you to know, I was mad. I was very mad. I was, and I did slap her. I never should have done it. And I apologize to you publicly for that. But my emotions got the best of me. You know, I've been married to my wife for almost 15 years. We've got four beautiful kids, and I worked hard. And at the time, I felt disrespected, not only by my wife, but this other officer who used that trust, and he also used his kids as a way to come over to my house continually, whether I was there or not. So once I found this out, I immediately started processing everything, and I realized I was in trouble. And so that's why I called Trooper Mark Shepard, who was the OIC at the time. And then I actually spoke with Lieutenant Simmons on the phone, who also told me he was on his way over to my house. There's no excuse for slapping her. It wasn't a Ray Rice slap, but it was a slap. I took pride in growing up, I've seen a little bit of domestic violence. I took pride in the fact that I'd never slapped my wife before or hit her. And so I let myself down, and I let her down, and, of course, other family members. And basically, I don't have any excuses. I'm sorry. I should have held myself to an even higher standard than what I did. And I would just hope you would try to put yourself in my shoes. And hopefully you'll never be in my shoes, but I wish you'd just try to be somewhat understanding. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Poole before he steps down from council? All right.
Nothing in rebuttal.
Can I come up? I'm his wife. No.
Okay. No, that's outside the parameters of the rules then. All right. No, there's no no further comment from the council. I'll take a motion or entertain a motion.
I'll recuse myself as well.
Okay. Colonel Feuer refuses.
Sorry, if I could add one more thing. I don't excuse my actions, but the one thing I did fail to mention is I feel my integrity is still intact. I did not lie. I did not cheat. I did not steal. I didn't falsify any government records, any type of records. I made a mistake, and I'm sorry. And I've had to pay for that in more ways than you'll ever know. But I've also completed everything for my diversion, anger management, domestic violence and parenting classes, in addition to my community service. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Anything else on rebuttal?
No, nothing else.
All right. I'll bring it back to council.
Is it appropriate to ask about treatment? I don't think we can, Jim, as far as family counseling, that type of thing, as a mitigating factor.
I think that's what the mountain. I mean, as far as just looking at strictly mitigating circumstances.
I guess my question would be, currently, are you seeking counseling or anything to deal with help?
Yes, we have had some counseling in the past. Both my wife and I did attend the parenting class together. I'm the only one that obviously took the domestic violence class and anger management. So that's, and I've already completed everything. I actually completed it ahead of time. From day one, I admitted to what I did, and I admitted it was wrong. And I don't need Garrity to tell the truth. I'm an open book. Anyone who knows me knows I'll tell the truth. So I just like you to consider that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pope. All right, I'll bring it back to the council.
I guess I'm sitting next to Chief Burbank, so I'm going to talk. We've already had a case of criminal mischief and a deviant and a domestic violence person and child. We did a 1 year. And this, as I read this, is still a Class B. Is that what he was charged with? Class B. So now we're in a 1 year, and now we're doing a 2.5 year. And I'm just wondering about our inconsistency on that. This seemed to be it happened, and he immediately recognized it and reported it and self-reported it. I'm just wondering why the difference.
I'd like to add to that.
All right.
I think my perception would be, if I look at the 1 year suspension, I think that's quite harsh. We're pulling a phone cord from the wall, and I think if we're going to be consistent, I would perceive that slapping somebody with children present and creating a physical hostile environment would seem consistent to me. I appreciate the difficulty, and I guess maybe I would speak to it's difficult for me to listen to these cases because there is a reality, which is we have a law that doesn't allow for domestic violence, but we also have reality of marriages that people fight and things happen, and that's why we have counseling. For officers, I think that it just needs to be known publicly that they're paying a tremendous price that many people wouldn't pay. They would simply meet with a therapist, and these officers are paying dearly for and being held well above and beyond the standard of just what the public would be. And I hope that's noted. So I think my perception would just be that if we're going to give somebody a year for pulling a phone cord out, I think 2.5 years is appropriate for somebody hitting their spouse in the presence of their children. So.
All right. Still looking for a motion.
Director, is the 2.5 years, is that the standard for physical domestic violence class B misdemeanor?
That is consistent with the guidelines, and okay. Guidelines were proposed to the council based on historical action.
Move to accept.
I have a motion to accept the 2.5 year suspension. Is there a second?
Second.
All right, a second. Is there further discussion from the council? Okay. All those in favor to accept the 2.5 year suspension, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Nay.
One. All right, we rule that the motion does pass. Next case.
The next matter before the council is a certification of Robert R. Randell. He's a former member of the Salt Lake City Police Department and former member of the Twilla County Sheriff's Office. The sustained allegations are assault and lying under Garrity, which falls under Category A of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is revocation. A summary of the facts are as follows. On August 13, 2013, Robert Randell was dispatched to a residential burglary. The suspect was arrested nearby by a second officer. Randell arrived at the suspect's location where the suspect was being questioned and searched. Randell engaged in a conversation with the suspect, which resulted in Randell striking the suspect in the face. Randell later told his supervisor he slapped the suspect. In Garrity interviews with Salt Lake City Police Department and Post, Randell denied slapping the suspect. Randell explained that when the suspect made a move towards his gun side, Randell checked him to the jawline to gain his compliance and control. On September 18, 2014, a hearing was held before an administrative law judge. The ALJ subsequently issued a findings of facts and conclusions of law stating Officer Robert Randell violated UCA 536.211 as outlined in the Notice of Agency Action.
All right, thank you. Is Mr. Randell here or his counsel?
Yes.
Please identify yourself.
I'm James Tanner. This is Robert Randell. I represent Officer Randell regarding this sanction and penalty decision. We ask that the administrative judge's findings not be followed in this case. In your disciplinary guidelines, you note that you may consider all the evidence in the record to determine an appropriate sanction. I've had Mr. Randell just hand out to you a handout of 4 hearing exhibits, which I expect to refer to. I will refer to the mitigating factors of the absence of malice or intent as it relates to the sanction, Officer Randell's performance and work history, and the presence of alternate sanctions to revocation. The suspect told the Salt Lake City Police IA investigators on August 14, 2013, that Officer Robert Randell slapped him twice during an arrest, which took place the day before. He stated that the tall Polynesian officer told him, "I told you if I saw you any more tonight, I would book you into jail." When the suspect said, "Oh, was that you?" Randell hit him a second time. According to the suspect, Officer Randell came up to him when he was sitting on the curb with no handcuffs and hit him. He never had handcuffs on when Randell allegedly struck him. Allegations of the suspect did not match facts known to the IA investigators, and in time, the post-investigative staff. Before Randell arrived, the suspect was in handcuffs. There was no supporting evidence that force was used twice. The suspect did not want Randell fired, and he didn't file criminal charges. Post did not call the suspect as a witness in the investigation or the post-hearing. And aside from the IA interview, the suspect's allegations were never tested by cross-examination. Now, you know that an officer's use of force is evaluated by what the officer knew and observed when the force was used, based on Graham versus Connor, the controlling U.S. Supreme Court case. Although the objective reasonableness standard from this case does not assess intent and malice, knowledge of the force that was reasonable and necessary provides a baseline to determine whether malice was involved in Randell's use of force. In regard to the first factor in the Connor decision, the severity of the crime, it is undisputed that Officer Randell knew that the suspect was being arrested for multiple felonies, counts of a burglary of an occupied dwelling at night. In regard to the second factor, a concern about an immediate threat, Randell testified that when he felt and saw movement toward his weapon sight, his training kicked in. He had time to hold the suspect's left wrist with his right hand and at the same instant use an open palm check in an upward motion to the right jaw of the suspect to distract the suspect's attention from moving toward his weapon sight. The open palm force was below intermediate force by Salt Lake City baton policy, defining intermediate force. Salt Lake City found that Randell's use of force was unnecessary, not unreasonable. A post theory central in this case against Randell was that any noncompliance of the suspect was caused by Randell, his use of force, due to the observation that the suspect was compliant for Officer Smith, the arresting officer, but not Randell. This is a logically flawed theory. It's based on observation of correlation, not causation. It does not account for the effects of alcohol upon the perception and reaction of the subject, or the risk of an exaggerated reaction by the suspect, a serious habitual offender. Post-investigator Dana observed in the post-investigation, the suspect would have not been expected to make a distinction between a legitimate check to the jaw and a slap. The judge held that an assault occurred due to a substantial chance of injury, despite the fact that no injury evidence is apparent in this case. This tort-like chance of injury test is at odds with the use of force allowed by the Supreme Court in the Connor decision, where, as you know, the court held peace officers have a right to use some degree of force, of physical coercion, to effect an arrest. And every push or shove is not unreasonable, even if it may seem unnecessary, with 20/20 hindsight, in the words of the court, in the peace of a judge's chambers. The test is not what was in the mind of the suspect. It is what Officer Randell observed and knew at the time he used a force as he stood next to the suspect. Did Randell see movement, even a furtive movement, one due to intoxication even, toward his weapon sight? Did he see the suspect being moved by Officer Smith while the suspect was being repositioned during a complicated search? Officer Smith saw blood and on the nose and mouth area of the suspect before Randell arrived at the arrest scene. He saw no new injuries on the suspect after Randell's use of force took place. The suspect described the force in the IA investigation as medium, although he could not accurately identify where the force had been used upon him. According to Officer Smith, the demonstrative photo at the top of your packet that we've passed out there depicts the physical positions of the parties when the arrest was occurring. Now, you actually see the photo depicting it would be the suspect and Sergeant Randell, Officer Randell, where he was standing. An exception is that the handcuffed hands should have been facing in, not out, according to Officer Smith. You see, The suspect's hands are in the small of his back. The officers bookended each side of the suspect. Randell was on the left. And as you see, Randell's weapon side was within inches of the handcuffed hands of the suspect. The recommendation to invoke Randell's certification was a result of a process which, in effect, excluded those with direct knowledge of the use of force. The suspect, Officer Randell, and other officers who observed the earlier interaction between the suspect and Randell. The post case rested on two witnesses, arresting Officer Smith, who saw no use of force and testified to seeing and hearing little, and Sergeant Brian Sloan, not a witness to force, who recalled facts that were inconsistent with other facts in the record. To begin with, Officer Randell asked the post investigator if the complainant and the other officers present in the earlier meeting that night could be interviewed. The investigator told him, their testimony is not relevant. The stipulated testimonies of Officer Tafisi and Peterson, the excluded officers, stated that they were present in the earlier police encounter that night, and they observed no threat to the suspect by Officer Randell. The judge dismissed Randell's sworn testimony regarding the use of force on the basis that there was a lack of independent evidence to support Randell's claim of the use of force other than his testimony. What do we need? As the judge made this ruling, he failed to acknowledge or evaluate the testimony, the stipulated by Post and Randell, testimony of Officers Tafisi and Randell in front of him and in front of you in your packet, providing independent, unrebutted evidence disproving the suspect's allegation of a revenge motive or malice in Randell's use of force. The judge further discounted Randell's credibility on the basis that he had a stake in the outcome, and he did not fill out the supplemental use of force form. The judge found that the suspect was intoxicated and that his testimony would have been very limited credibility, not central to this case. And then he said he believed the suspect, that he was compliant. The judge found that the suspect would have been compliant because, due to the suspect's previous contact with the law, he knew the police procedures for handcuffing and searching, and he would have not have been surprised or startled by such activities. Well, what is this police record referenced by the judge and stipulated by both parties? It's a summary. The record does not speak of affinity toward police officers or a likelihood of compliance with their orders. In the previous 9 years, the suspect had 146 arrests approximately, 90 convictions, charges including false information, impersonating and assaulting a police officer, approximately 20 theft charges, approximately 40 alcohol-related offenses, as well as drug-related and trespassing charges. He was a serious habitual offender. Officer Smith, the arresting officer, testified that he wore a ball cap, and this cap restricted his vision as he looked down to search. He could not see the opposite side of the suspect, including Randell's weapon side. He did not see or hear Officer Randell, his use of force with the suspect, although he stood directly next to the suspect when the force was used. He testified that although the suspect was compliant to begin with, he initially complied in the handcuffing phase and when he asked him to sit down, the suspect was not fully compliant when asked if there was anything that could poke Smith. When Smith felt a bump on one occasion, he noticed the suspect close the gap and distance between the suspect and himself. Randell asked a question, Smith recalls, that implied that they knew each other from before. Smith testified he heard no yelling, no red flags, a firm tone in Randell's communication. He heard no responses from Randell back to the suspect, although the suspect was accusing Randell of using force and Smith of being a dirty cop. Officer Smith testified in the administrative hearing that he could not feel Randell searching on the other side of the suspect. His lack of ability to feel a search on the other side of the intoxicated suspect, he described as unsteady on his feet, was surely affected by the physical distance and gap, as he described it, that existed between the suspect and himself. Smith, Officer Smith, the arresting officer, was engaged in serious multitasking, a complicated search of multiple layers of clothing involving a belt, elastic band, which he ultimately retrieved, stolen jewelry, and shards of glass. Sergeant Brian Sloan, temporarily performing an arrest check, interviewed the suspect at the arrest scene. Sloan then drove to the burglary scene and interviewed Officer Randell without Garrity regarding the alleged assault. The interview on the driveway of the dwelling had no recording and, of course, no verbatim transcript. It's a baseline to determine the falsification. It did not include the questions asked, the responses made, or the context in which the words were used. Sloan's ability to perceive and recall is brought into question by the fact that he had a several-minute interview with the suspect, and he did not know he was intoxicated, despite the fact the judge found he was intoxicated, but Officers Randell and Smith, it was readily apparent to him that he was intoxicated. Sloan's memory on the use of force varied. Sloan's certainty that Randell used the word slapped in the hearing was preceded by his testimony to the post investigator that he wasn't sure, but maybe Randell told him it was a closed fist. Sloan testified that Randell spoke of the use of force when he brought the burglary victim back to ID the suspect. Sloan's testimony contradicts the testimony of Officer Smith, Randell, and the suspect. It is undisputed in the record. The use of force occurred during the arrest and search phase, not the later witness ID phase, when Randell and the burglary victim returned to ID the suspect and remained in Randell's patrol car the entire time, parked over 40 feet from the suspect. Smith's claim, the entire case rests on Smith and his testimony. His claim that he had to encourage the suspect to cooperate, Sloan's claims. Sloan had to encourage the suspect to cooperate as the suspect ranted about Randell while being photographed. This claim is inconsistent with the sworn testimony of Crime Lad photographer Trin. She testified that she recalled that Sloan did not even arrive at the scene until she was leaving after the photos had been taken. She recalled that the suspect complained about the burglary victim who had struck and chased him, not Randell, as Sloan has claimed. These inconsistencies can be further evaluated by the fact that Randell was an experienced post instructor who taught law enforcement officers in this building for a period of years techniques such as check and redirect. Although Sergeant Sloan testified during the post-investigation, he had never heard of and he had never received training in a check technique. The stipulated testimony of Sergeant Glenn Perret verifies that this is a legitimate post-defensive technique and the word slapped is not part of the training. Why would Randell lose control by slapping and then, with an awareness of its negative consequences, casually admit to a supervisor, as the story goes, that he did not know well that he was slapping someone? Couldn't he be a better liar if he was going to lie? Sergeant Sloan may have become angered by Randell's short response. While Randell performed multiple tasks busy at the crime scene while being questioned by Sloan, Randell responded with a phrase brought things to his remembrance. A phrase he had previously read in the Bible to describe returning mentally to the present situation. In this case, a need for a suspect to mentally return to the fact that he was in the arrest process. There was no opportunity to elaborate on this explanation with Sergeant Sloan. Randell testified that Sloan cut the conversation off, turned, and drove off in his vehicle. The judge questioned why Randell didn't run after Sloan's departing vehicle. The record reveals Randell simply chose to honor his obligation, not to leave an active felony crime scene to chase after Sloan's vehicle. As Sloan was meeting with Salt Lake City Police Department managers on how to blue team Randall, how to end his career, unknown to Randall. Randall and Sloan had a flawed understanding of the facts as he did it. Randall stayed after his shift had ended to ensure the preservation of evidence from the burglary scene. As you know, in Benson versus Post Counsel, the Utah Court of Appeals held that you, as a post counsel, must be satisfied that a material fact was misrepresented in the falsification cases that you review. In Randell's case, the post notice contained no specific fact that was falsified. How do you defend against that? The precise words in the question by Sloan have varied. In his IA investigation, Sloan testified that he asked Randall, "Hey, this guy says you hit him twice. What's going on with that?" Randall, throughout the investigations, consistently responded with words to the effect, "No, I brought things to his remembrance." There is no evidence to show that Randall was not truthful when he responded that he did not use force twice. Randall testified in both the IA investigation on September 6th and the post-investigation November 25th, the dates he is charged with falsifying, that he used force, and the specific force he used was a check and a redirect technique. According to the record, Ron Randall came to the U.S. from New Zealand. He played as a member of the United States national rugby team for 7 years. He served as a police officer for approximately 15 years prior to 2013. Early in his career, he made a mistake regarding the use of force, and at one point, he was given a last chance agreement. After that experience, he learned the rules of use of force, and he noted, as we've noted, he served as a post instructor on defensive tactics from 2004. His assignments often involved a significant likelihood of violence. He served on the Salt Lake City gang unit, the SWAT team, the downtown bike patrol near Pioneer Park area. He was recognized with 4 other officers for rushing in and silencing the shooter in the Trolley Car Square massacres in 2007. He was recognized for peacefully ending a hostage crisis in recent years. He was notified that he was next on Chief Burbank's sergeant promotion list for 2013. Aside from the lack of feeling of a search on the other side of an intoxicated suspect, there is no testimony of any witness to rebut Randell's claim that he saw movement of the suspect toward his weapon sight. Post did not demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that Randall did not see this movement or that any fact during Garrity was falsified. In the absence of malice, with the availability of sanctions less than revocation, we ask that no sanction or a sanction of a warning or suspension be imposed in this matter.
Council members, I would just quickly refer you to what's contained in your packets, the ALJ's finding of facts and conclusion of law, and just remind you to review that. That is what the ALJ found in regards to all the facts and conclusions in a formal hearing that was conducted with Mr. Randall and with Post. In that, we have a statement by the individual that he slapped the individual, and then the judge found, the ALJ subsequently found that in a Garrity interview, he did not, it was contrary to that statement that he had previously made. And that's it.
All right, thank you.
I will be recusing myself.
All right, Chief Burbank will recuse himself. And you also will be? Okay, thank you, Mr. Bailey. All right, any questions from the counsel for either Mr. Randell or for counsel.
One point of clarification, you stated in here, I brought things to his remembrance. What is that? What was that related to?
Mr. Randell, explain that again.
Just a reference to a biblical scripture.
And as I mentioned, what he had indicated is it specifically refers, if I understand him correctly, to bringing someone's mental thinking back to the presence. And in this case, it was a suspect in the arrest process. That was his explanation.
Is that related to using force? Or?
To my knowledge, it was related to using force because he was questioned about using force. But that was his explanation in the IA investigation. He's not saying the scripture allowed him to use force or authorized him or allowed him to use any certain amount of force. It involved mental thinking and bringing someone back to the presence. That's his explanation.
Any more summation from counsel?
Just as a clarification as the council deliberates, I'm reading from Utah Code 53-6-211 subsection 4. This is the statute that kind of governs what this council does during these deliberations. So I'm just going to read you the statute. The statute shall review the findings and facts and conclusions of law and the information contained or information concerning the peace officer provided by the officer's employing agency and determine whether to suspend or revoke the officer's certification. And we've had this problem before. It's kind of tricky with having kind of bifurcating the finding of facts part of our administrative action and the imposing sanctioning, which is what this council does. I think at the very least, a officer can raise whatever issues they have with the ALJ decision just for issue preservation. Should they get an adverse ruling and wish to appeal to the Court of Appeals, they do need to preserve those issues. However, at least with the reading of the statute in subsection 4, shall review the findings of facts and the conclusions of law. So I'm just putting that out there for deliberation.
If I could give input to respond to what counsel just mentioned, if I could, from our perspective.
The case that I cited, Benson versus Utah Post, was not talking about sanction. It looked at a falsification case squarely, post-counsel, 2011, and said, in essence, it said you blew it. You did not have the element showing that someone intentionally misrepresented. That was the elements of the offense, not just sanction, is our position. What I do know, and counsel has observed this, in the typical situation, you have a trier of fact, a judge or jury. They hear the case. They hear the evidence it's going in. You've designed your own process. But your process, if I understand it right, is we've challenged and we will challenge what the judge has done. But before you sign off, and one reason we don't want you to recommend or we do not want you to adopt a revocation penalty sanction is the fact that we simply think the elements were not made. That is one reason we believe you should not adopt it. But having said that, we believe that you do not know, if I understand it right, in the typical trier of fact, what the record is, unless we tell you in our 20-minute presentation. And so we ask you to consider that fact that Benson versus post-counsel, Utah Court of Appeals, they say you need to look at the substance of the offense as we read it.
If I can make a motion and discussion before I make that motion.
Okay.
Based on the fact that the ALJ, that they were heard before and the judge found that assault that had taken place, did take place, and also found that there was a violation of Garrity, this council has been very clear and passed on violations of Garrity, where it's an automatic revocation. We really have never deferred from that. So based on the fact that they were able to have their case heard, it was ruled on, the recommendation is the post is that those two violations did occur, and that revocation falls within the Garrity violations. I'm recommending that we follow post recommendation of revocation on this case.
We have a motion for revocation. Do we have a second?
Could I ask for one point of clarification? Was the IA investigation recorded through Salt Lake PD? Was that, I was a little unclear on that.
Yes, it was.
Okay. Thank
you. All right. We have a motion for ratification. We have a second.
Second.
We have a second. Rossman. Any further discussion before the vote? All right. All those in favor of ratification, say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right. We vote that it was ratification. Vote that that passes.
All right. Next place. Next case.
The next matter before the council is a certification of Blake C. Roundy. He was not employed at the time of the offense. If the sustained allegations are discharge of a firearm within 600 feet of cattle and littering, which falls under Category E of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a six-month suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On or about March 5, 2014, Blake Roundy was target shooting with friends on private land in an area where walk-in access is allowed. Roundy discharged his firearm near a cattle stockyard and did not collect his trash and spent shell casings when he left the area. Law enforcement officers made contact with Roundy's days later and cited him for littering and discharging his firearm near a cattle stockyard. On March 26, 2014, Roundy pled guilty to both charges and entered into a plea in abeyance agreement. On December 3, 2014, Roundy waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
All right, thank you. Is Mr. Roundy or his counsel here? Seeing no representation, I'll bring it back to the council for a motion.
Move to accept the 6 months.
Okay, we have a motion to accept the 6 month suspension. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a second. All those, any further discussion? All those in favor of the 6 month suspension, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, that passes.
Next case.
The next matter before the council is the certification of Larry Spritzer, former member of the Utah Department of Corrections. Sustained allegation is theft, which falls under Category D of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a one-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On August 2, 2014, Larry Spritzer was observed on security cameras stealing food from the kitchen in the correctional facility where he worked. Spritzer was interviewed by a supervisor and admitted to stealing food on multiple occasions over the previous months. Spritzer was previously disciplined for stealing food in April 2014. Spritzer resigned from the UDC prior to a formal internal investigation. On November 3, 2014, Post conducted a Garrity interview with Spritzer. During the interview, Spritzer admitted to stealing food from the kitchen of the correctional facility on multiple occasions, including August 2, 2014. On February 3, 2015, Spritzer waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
All right. Is Mr. Spritzer or his counsel present? Seeing no representation, I'll bring it back to the committee, or excuse me, to the council. For a motion? Okay. A motion to accept the one-year suspension. Is there a second?
No.
Oh, the motion to recuse. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I can't hear you. All right. Motion to recuse and then motion to accept. All right. Is there a second? And a second. All right. Proper second. All those in favor of the one-year suspension, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. The rule that passes. Next case.
Next matter before the council is the certification of Travis Timothy. He's a former current member of the Utah. He's a current member of the Utah Department of Corrections. Sustained allegation is open container, which falls under Category F of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a letter of caution. A summary of the facts are as follows. On August 29, 2014, Travis Timothy was stopped for speeding by a local police agency. During the stop, the officer observed an open container of alcohol in the passenger area of the vehicle. The officer did not observe any evidence that would suggest Timothy was consuming the alcohol. Timothy was issued a citation for driving with an open container of alcohol in the vehicle. On January 20th, 2015, Timothy waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
All right. Is Mr. Timothy all right, Mr. Timothy?
First, I'd like to start by just saying I stand here with a heavy heart of regret. This is not how I'd like to meet members of the council, and for that I am sorry. I'm here today to stand accountable for my actions. I made a poor decision by having an open container in my vehicle, one I've regretted every day for almost 8 months. I wish I could go back and change my actions of that day, but I can't. The only thing I can do is learn from my mistakes and use what I've learned to become a better person and a better officer. I just want to take a second to apologize to my family and my department for representing them in the way I did. I truly regret the way I've represented my department and my family. The only thing I can say is from what I've learned from this experience is, members of this council, is that you'll never see me here again. I just only can wish that this council will allow me to continue working in this career that I am honored to be a part of and a career that I love. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal? All right, thank you. Bring it back to the council for any discussion or motion. Colonel Fear?
Motion to accept the letter of caution.
Okay, motion to accept the letter of caution. Is there a second?
Second.
A second, Chief Stratton. Any further discussion? All right. Bring it to a vote. All those in favor of the letter of caution, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you.
We'll rule that pass.
Next case.
The next matter before the council is the certification of Peter Walcott. He's a current member of the Wasatch Constable's Office. Sustained allegation is falsifying information to obtain certification, which falls under Category C of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a two-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On January 27, 2015, Peter Walcott submitted a letter to Post in which he admitted to using his wife's prescription narcotic for medical reasons in July 2013. This information was not on Walcott's Post application. Walcott stated when he remembered the misuse, he did not inform Post because he thought he may be dismissed from the academy. He did self-report this information to Post, and on March 5th, 2015, Walcott waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
All right, thank you. Is Mr. Walcott here or his representation? Seeing no representation, I'll bring it back to the committee for, unless there's anything further from council. Bring it back to the committee for a motion or discussion. A thoughtful group.
Motion to 2 years suspension.
All right, we have a motion by Sheriff Decker for a 2 year suspension. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, we have a second. Any further discussion? All right, all those in favor of the 2 year suspension, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, we'll rule that that passes. And next case.
The final matter before the Post Council is the certification of Martha Marie Zeman. She is a former member of the Lone Peak Police Department. The sustained allegations are falsification or alteration of a government record, which falls under Category D of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a one-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On June 21, 2014, Martha Zeman was dispatched to a dog-at-large complaint. Zeman arrived at the reporting party's residence and took custody of the dog. Zeman placed the dog in the animal control truck and began transporting it to the shelter. Zeman said that while en route to the shelter, the dog was whining. It would not be quiet. Zeman pulled over and took the dog out of the truck, set it on the ground, and drove away. Zeman later completed an incident report in which she stated that when she arrived at the complainant's address, the dog had escaped and could not be located. During a post-Garrity interview, Zeman admitted to intentionally letting the dog go and intentionally falsifying the incident report to indicate she had never taken custody of the dog. On March 6, 2015, Zeman waived her right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
All right, thank you. Is Ms. Zeman here or her counsel? Seeing no representation, then I'll bring it back to the council for further discussion or a motion.
Motion to accept.
All right, motion to accept a 1-year suspension. Is there a second?
Discussion.
A second?
Discussion.
Oh, discussion? Here we go.
Okay. I have a question. Why are we giving somebody that lies on an application 2-year suspension, but you lie in an official police report, it's a submission of records, a 1-year suspension? That's kind of confusing because if you blatantly lie in a police report, which is facts that just happened, something's on an application, I can understand. That was 10 years ago, you know, whatever. But an automatic police report, which is an official record that can be subpoenaed by courts, grandma request, everything else, goes directly to the credibility of the officer and the agency and this body itself.
And I think you can make an argument, and I'll certainly defer to the legal, that you got some implied Garrity going on here. The implied... Let's tell the truth when we write a police report sort of thing.
Basically,
I think it all falls under that bigger review that we need to have in the future, but I do have some concern, as my colleague here to my left does as well.
Just for clarification, just so...
If there is any potential appeal or anything, she did admit to her actions in a Garrity interview.
All right, thank you. We did have a motion. Did we have a second? Oh, we had a second.
We don't have a second. Is that what you're saying?
So far, we don't. That's correct. Bring it back for an alternative motion or further discussion.
You're supposed to make these things easier. I'll second it just to get out of
this. Okay, we'll make a second and now open it for further discussion. Okay. Duly noted, though, your point as an issue for the next meeting. All right, we have a motion for a 1-year suspension and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Nay.
Go ahead and raise your hands so we can. Okay, we have two names. I will rule that the motion did pass. Thank you very much. And we'll return to the...
Can I say something?
Yes,
sure. Just so my staff and myself are clear on my marching orders for the next council meeting, we'll throw some language out to address some of these line issues. But historically in the past, this has come up. Specifically, Chief Larson from Orem several years back had the same concerns that several of you had lying, period. And that's when the council became a little harsher on lying in their areas. So we'll have this discussion in June, and we'll prepare some language for this body's review. Additionally, regarding the administrative rule and the sanctions of not reporting, I will add some of the other recommendations, and I'll send it to his body. And then also, if you can encourage your respective associations to please reach out to me if they have any concerns. Because what typically happens when I push the button and send, I don't get much feedback until the midnight hour. So please instruct, please encourage them to be preemptive with me. So,
all right, thank you. That's good advice. All right. Scheduled for the next meeting would be
June.
Do we have a date?
We have to review this. We typically do the second week of June, but the entire month of June is open.
Is there a preference?
Let's throw out June 8th.
Okay, June 8th.
Yeah, how about the 15th? The 8th, they got the children's symposium and other stuff going on at the same time.
15th?
June 15th? All right, we'll set it for June 15th. Be here at 10 o'clock. All right, that's post-council meeting at 10 o'clock. All right, I'll make a, or take an entertaining motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
All right, second. All right, all in favor, say aye. We are adjourned. Thank you.